The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Maurice Williams, and it's my great privilege to welcome each of you to the Free Library of Philadelphia. You're in for a great treat tonight, but first let me ask you to turn off your cell phones and remind you that no flash photography, and encourage you to buy this book, First Family, Abigail and John Adams, by our speaker, Joe Ellis, and join him upstairs for a book signing after the talk and the question and answer. You've got lots of information in the bulletin about Professor Ellis. Let me just add a couple of observations that you might find of interest. One is that he taught at West Point before going to Mount Holyoke. So he has and served in the U.S. Army, so that he has a military perspective from experience, as well as writing about the military dimensions of the founding of our nation. The second is, I think that Professor Ellis has written a love story about Abigail and John Adams in the midst of what is a fascinating review of the developments that led to the creation of America and its early start. And the third observation is simply to read from one portion of his book, which is, to me, a reminder that as bad as we think politics might be today, we don't have anything over the founding fathers. When John Adams became president, he kept George Washington's cabinet, and the Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, the Secretary of War, as Professor Ellis relates, basically felt that they owed their allegiance to Alexander Hamilton. And so they were running everything by Alexander Hamilton before it was acted on in the cabinet in their work with Adams. And so let me just read you what he says, though, about Vice President Thomas Jefferson. Quote, John Adams did not know that at that very moment Jefferson was engaged in clandestine conversations with the French consul in Philadelphia, urging him to ignore any peace initiative from Adams, who did not speak for the true interests of the American people. Despite his recent election, by most measures, such behavior verged on treason. Let me invite you to join me in welcoming Professor Joe Ellis, who is uniquely qualified not only because of his work on John Adams, but remember, he's written books about George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, the Founding Brothers. So please, let's give a warm Philadelphia welcome, Professor Joe Ellis.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for that gracious, maybe overly gracious, introduction. It's really a pleasure to be with you again. I was here twice before, and this is an extraordinary audience. let me just say at the start that at the Free Library, let me announce that the book will never die. And that at least before me. I'm on the book tour trail, and I've discovered that I don't know how to talk about this book with the same level of coherence that I have in previous books, in part because I've never written a love story before. And that's basically what this is. Now, it's a love story lived across an extraordinarily consequential historical landscape. But how to put it? How many of you have ever, remember the movie came out in the late 1960s called That's Entertainment. Remember that? It's a series of film clips from great MGM musicals. My favorite is Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe with Judy Garland. Ugh. There's an early shot clip in which, of still in his prime, Fred Astaire does a 2-minute, 37-second dance with Eleanor Powell. Now, I don't want to offend anybody, but Eleanor Powell makes... Eleanor Powell is the best dancer that Fred Astaire ever danced with. It's really great. And then Frank Sinatra comes out and says, you know, you can sit around and wait, but you're never going to see that again. You're never going to see Abigail and John again either. It's an extraordinarily rare story, which is composed of two strands. One is private, their love, their definition of love, their sustaining of love, their changed understanding of what that means over 59 years, across the landscape of the American Revolution, the diplomatic affairs of America and Europe in the 1780s, and the creation of the American Republic. You can usually get one of those things, but you can't get them together, or seldom. And it's what really, it was the reason I wrote the book. Here's how I try to put it. All of us who have fallen in love, tried to raise children, suffered extended bouts of doubt about the integrity of our ambitions, watched our once youthful bodies betray us, harbored illusions about our impregnable principles, and done all this with a partner traveling the same trail, know what unconditional commitment means and why, especially today, it's the exception rather than the rule. Abigail and John traveled down that trail about 200 years ago, 200 years before us. They remained friends and lovers throughout, and together had a hand in laying the foundation of what is now the oldest enduring republic in world history. And they left a written record of all the twitches, traumas, throbbings, and tribulations along the way. No one else has ever done that. And one of the reasons for writing this book was to figure out how they did do it. It's the quality of the letters, the volume and the quality of the letters that gives you the material for the story. I knew I had a great story, and then I knew I had the evidence to support it. That's a great moment as a writer. There are about 1,200 letters between them that have survived. They probably wrote about twice that many. One of the reasons there are so many letters is that they are apart so often. Madison, Jimmy Madison and Dolly don't have much of a correspondence at all because they are always together. Abigail was in Braintree while John was in Philadelphia. Abigail was in Braintree, then Quincy when John was in Paris and Amsterdam. And then during his vice presidency, second term, she was too sick. She had rheumatoid arthritis, and she stayed most of the second term of his vice presidency up in Braintree. So that there's more. It's the irony. The more they're apart, the more we know about their intimacy. So the separation and distance is one explanation for the number of letters. Another is at a certain stage, John and then Abigail both concluded that they were living through a historic time and that they wanted to record this time for posterity. Now, if you ask John what posterity was, he would say it was his family. His descendants. But what he really meant by the end was us. He's writing this to us so that he can live on in a form of secular immortality. He's not so sure about the hereafter. He has a great line. He says, if it can ever be shown conclusively that there is no life after death, my advice to every man, woman, and child on the planet is to take opium. The volume of the letters then have some explanations that I've offered, but the quality of them is just, I mean, Martha Washington and George Washington wrote presumably a lot of letters, and George requested that they be destroyed at his death, which Martha did, except for three that she missed. I still don't think they'd be anything like the Adams letters. Abigail has a great line. She says, "My pen is freer than my tongue. I can write to you in ink what I cannot say." So that these are letters which are extraordinarily literary and candid and insightful. And let me just give you a very brief example. Right when they're ending their courtship, just before they are ready to get married. This is in 1764. Abigail was apparently more than half serious when, a few months before their wedding, she asked John to deliver on his promise, which was, "And tell me all my faults, both of omission and commission, and all the evil you know or think of me." John responded with a mock catalog of your faults, imperfections, deficits, or whatever you please to call them. She was, he observed, negligent at playing cards, could not sing a note, often hung her head like a bulrush, sat with her legs crossed, was pigeon-toed, and to cap it off, she read too much. Abigail responded that many of these defects were probably incurable, and especially the reading, so he would have to learn to live with them. The leg-crossing charge struck her as awkward, since, as she put it, a gentleman has no business to concern himself with the legs of a lady. The letters exchanged during their courtship provide the fullest and first window into the chemistry of their relationship, but it would probably be wrong to assume that the correspondence accurately reflected the way they talked to each other when they were together. Letter writing in the 18th century was a more deliberative and self-consciously artful exercise than those of us in the present with our cell phones, email, and text messaging can fully fathom. It's a psychologically different culture. The letters, of course, all we have to recover the texture of their emotional and intellect, or of their overlapping personalities. And while these letters constitute a long string of emotional and intellectual pearls unmatched in the literature of the era, they were also self-conscious performances, quasi-theatrical presentations. There are some things, in short, that we can never know for sure about their deepest thoughts and feelings, even though they are among the most fully revealed couples in American history. We will never know as much about a president and a first lady in the future of the republic because they won't write letters. They'll all be lost in space. Two essential ingredients in their lifetime dialogue were clear from the start. First, Abigail, despite the lack of any formal education, she was homeschooled by her mother, her father, and her grandmother, Abigail could match John with a pen, which was saying quite a lot, since he proved to be one of the master letter writers of an age not lacking in serious contenders, two of them being Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. Second, there was a presumed sense of psychological equality between them that Abigail expected and that John found intoxicating. She was marrying a man who loved the fact that she was, as he put it, saucy. And he was marrying a woman who was simultaneously capable of unconditional love and personal independence. If you had trouble with the fact that she was a wife and mother who could also read Descartes out loud to the children, that was your problem. There were so many topics they recognized from the beginning that they were a rare match. There were so many topics that they could talk about easily, and just as many things that they didn't have to talk about at all. The wedding occurred almost not so, you know, it's October 25th, 1764, in the same parlor of her father's house in Weymouth, where initially they had found themselves so uninteresting. In her last letter to John before the wedding, Abigail asked him to take all her belongings, which she was forwarding in a cart, to their new home in Braintree. "And then, sir," she wrote, "if you please, you may take me." That gives you a sense of what this correspondence is. I want to dip you in a couple of moments, take another 15 or 20 minutes, and then throw it open to questions from you so that you may escape at a reasonable hour. One thing I thought about as a moment is the summer of 1777. Politically, it's an important moment because John's down in the Continental Congress and William Howe and the British Army is moving, and they're not sure where they're going. Are they going up the Hudson to meet with Burgoyne's force? Are they going to capture Philadelphia? Turns out they're going all the way around the Chesapeake, the southern end of the Chesapeake, and come up at Philadelphia from the south side. Weird. Adam says it's almost like they're going to California to attack us from the backside. Meanwhile, those are the British movements. There are other movements inside Abigail because she's pregnant. And there's a lot of letters exchanged between them in the spring because John feels bad that he's not there. Their way of talking about pregnancy is elliptical because the 18th century etiquette doesn't permit direct discussion of these matters. In early June, Abigail says she felt something move or something go wrong inside her. It now takes 2 weeks for a letter to get to Philadelphia from Braintree. So Adams keeps writing during this time about the movements of the British Army. And Abigail is basically, she thinks maybe something seriously wrong here. Then she starts to have contractions, and she writes to him in between contractions and tells him, "I don't think this is good." And it turns out to be a stillborn child, Elizabeth. Perfect. Everything's perfect. Nothing wrong with her. I think it was strangulation by the umbilical cord, but I'm not sure. To her sixth pregnancy in 13 years, it's her last pregnancy. She's 33. But John will be gone so much that they won't have any more children. I was going to tell you that story, but I decided not to. The most famous letter that's in the correspondence is March 31st, 1776. It's the Remember the Ladies letter. John is down in Philadelphia leading the radical group inside the Continental Congress pushing for independence, which is the radical position. And Abigail writes him in March, and she has lots to say in this letter about the fact that the British Army's leaving Boston looks like a series, looks like a forest, the masts moving across the Massachusetts Bay. And then she says, "And by the way," now listen up, whenever someone says, "by the way," look out, because something is coming. "And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire that you will remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than their ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power in the hands of husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." Woo! Abigail is saying the arguments that John has been hurling at George III have serious implications for the family and for patriarchy and for women's rights. And she sees that pretty clearly. Is she serious? Yes. Is she bantering? Yes. They do that a lot in their letters. John's initial response said that he cannot but laugh at this suggestion, and has no intention of surrendering the despotism of George III for what he calls the despotism of the petticoat. They volley for a couple weeks on this, and she gets the last word. But you must remember that arbitrary power is like most things that are very hard. And notwithstanding all your wise laws and maxims, we have it in our power not only to free ourselves, but to subdue our masters, and without violence throw your natural and legal authority at your feet. Abigail really does see, consciously, the implications of the ideology that's being used in the American Revolution as it relates to the role of women in society. She sees that. She sees it all the way through, not just to the issue of the vote, but to the issue of power. However, she's not really a feminist, because she is so far ahead of her time. And she has no desire to become an alienated Mary Wollstonecraft. Her deepest satisfaction comes from being a mother and a wife. And she raises her only daughter as a traditional New England woman. The most important decision for any traditional New England woman is not where to go to college, but who to marry. Unfortunately, Abigail pushes her in a direction that proves to be disastrous. She marries a schmuck. Though he's a good-looking schmuck, and he fails at everything and leaves her in a terrible state. And she dies in John's arms in 1811 from breast cancer. But she is the daughter Abigail raised, okay, and which is one of the clearest statements that Abigail is not here to produce a generation of female protesters. I would call her proto-feminist. This episode is also interesting from John's side and from the public side of the ledger here. In the spring of 1776, when she writes him, John is pushing hard to develop a clear and consensus among the 13 different colonies for independence. That has been a minority position for a year, but it's gaining strength in response to British policy. The main force for the moderate position is Philadelphia's own John Dickinson. The last thing he wants is to complicate the political agenda. He knows that the ideas being suggested have certain implications. One of them is slavery must go. The other is the property qualification must go. The other is women have rights that need to be included. But the last thing we want you to do is raise these issues now. Let these issues come up after we agree on independence, after independence is won. Agreed. It's going to be an evolutionary revolution, not like the French Revolution. It's going to be slow. We're going to sip. It's the hot soup. We're going to blow on it and sip it. The French are going to drink it and scald their throats. That's actually one thing that John says. So that what we got here is another, not just a moment in Abigail's evolution towards an understanding of the role that women should have in society, and then her way of coping with that when it's 200 years ahead of its time, but it's also an example of Adams as a kind of conservative revolutionary who wishes the American revolutionary agenda to proceed slowly and not to have anything that interferes at the time with the crucial vote on independence itself. And I think both are, that's who they were, you know, in both instances, Adams is a kind of proto-feminist, and Adams John Adams is a kind of, Abigail is a proto-feminist, and John Adams is a kind of conservative revolutionary. The second moment I want to dip you in is the presidency of Adams. If you want to look and find some Tea Party precedents back there, just take a look at the partisan press releases of the 1790s. I was saying this at the dinner with some of the trustees, that when Washington leaves office in 1797, really, March, the Republican organ, the Aurora, says, "We must devoutly pray for his imminent death. That we have evidence that Washington was a traitor during the entire Revolutionary War, was secretly in league with the Brits," which, of course, is total nonsense. And then Adams comes in, and they say Adams is intending to crown his son, John Quincy, his successor, and name himself king. He's going to bring 24 prostitutes over from London for the White House, but it's not called the White House yet. And mostly, he's just crazy. He is deranged, mentally deranged. That's the way, you know, they didn't call him a socialist or a Muslim, but they called him a lot of worse things in some sense. And it's in that partisan culture that you have to understand what happens, and it's really a tragedy here. Abigail becomes an ultra-federalist, more so than her husband, and a strong supporter for the Alien and Sedition Acts, because her men are being attacked here, you know, her husband and her son, and she's the lioness protecting the lair. So she strongly urges John to sign the Alien and Sedition Acts, which on the alien side allow us to deport people of different origin if they say anything critical of the government. And if you're a newspaper editor, if you say something hostile to the government or to the chief executive and it's proven to be libelous, then you can go to prison. And they actually indict 37 people, very few of whom ever actually serve much. But the Alien and Sedition Acts are the single most grievous mistake that Adams made during his presidency. He later regretted him. It's clear that he wouldn't have, well, it's pretty clear that he himself was undecided, and it was Abigail's forceful pressure on this that caused him to do this. It's the only occasion in their history as a political team when she actually led him astray. In the election of 1800 that followed, Abigail was the designated vote counter. John wasn't allowed to conspicuously be aware that he was a candidate. If you announced that you were a candidate and you were running for office, that was testimony that you didn't deserve to be elected. You were a prostitute. So she kept track, and basically what happened in 1800 is Aaron Burr bought the New York legislature for $50,000. The New York legislature selected 12 of the electors. That's what threw Adams, that Adams had won New York in the previous election. Jefferson won it. The prize for this was Burr was made vice president. They knew in the spring, May, they were going to lose the election. There was no chance. And they weren't even thinking about it. And here's the personal and the public coming back together. The big, big thing in their lives was their son, Charles, who was at that time 30 and practicing law in New York after having graduated from Harvard Law School. But he had become an alcoholic and a drug addict. And his wife eventually spilled the beans on him. And Abigail went to see him, and John went to see him, and he simply refused to change. And the same week they found out the results of the Electoral College vote, first week of December of 1801 or of 1800, they found out that Charles had died. And everybody always wonders why Adams didn't stick around for Jefferson's inauguration. Well, part of it is he was an unprecedented moment. We never had a change in regimes before. Adams didn't think he was supposed to stay, but mostly he wanted to go back to New York and console Charles's widow. He had family stuff on his mind. Abigail said the same thing. She said, "I have suffered much in my life. This is the blow from which I will never recover." When one of your children die before you do, it's difficult. I got lots of good stories like that, but here's how the book ends. Abigail dies in 1818, 8 years before John. When she's dying, he crawls into bed with her and says, "I would just like to lie down here and die too." He ages pretty well. He keeps worrying in his old age about what he calls dying at the top. That means dementia, Alzheimer's. He does just the opposite. His mind gets even more vivacious and active and dynamic. Meanwhile, his body shrivels up and he loses all his hair and his teeth, and he can't walk very far. But finally, late June of 1826, on June 30th, he received a delegation requesting some statement from the great patriarch for the looming Independence Day celebration. It was going to be the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Declaration of Independence. "I will give you independence forever," he declared. Asked if he might like to elaborate, he declined. "Not a word," he said. He had finally learned at the very end the gift of silence, something he never had before. Abigail would have approved. Physicians and others, visitors, came away from his bedside convinced that the end was near. On the evening of July 4th, he lay in his bed, breathing with difficulty, apparently unable to speak. But when apprised that it was the 4th and the 50th anniversary of Independence Day, he lifted his head and with obvious effort declared, "It is a great day. It is a good day." Late in the afternoon, he stirred in response to several thunderstorms, subsequently described in eulogies as the artillery of heaven, and was heard to whisper, "Thomas Jefferson survives," by several bedside observers. There are some historians that have questioned this. This is true. He really did say this. We got three different witnesses. But by a coincidence that defied the probabilities of history and even the parameters of fiction, Jefferson had died earlier that afternoon. Both patriarchs, each possessed of indomitable willpower, seemed determined to die on schedule. Monroe tried to do it, too. He missed by one day, July 3rd. John drew his last breath shortly after 6 o'clock. Witnesses reported that a final clap of thunder sounded at his passing, and then a bright sun broke through the clouds. An estimated 4,000 people attended the funeral at the First Congregational Church 3 days later in Quincy as his body was laid to rest alongside Abigail's. They have remained together ever since. Thank you very much. What I didn't tell you, I had a hip replacement 6 weeks ago. So this is good, you know? We got time for questions, and they've got mics and stuff for people. You know the routine here better than I do, right? Have I prompted anything in the way of a question or a comment? There's some things over here that I see. I'll let the persons with the mic make the decisions.
Joe, summer of 1787, we found John in London. We found Jefferson in Paris.
Right.
What if they were here in town?
Ah.
What would have happened to the convention?
That's a good point. You're absolutely right, because they are founders that were not present at the debate over the Constitution, either here in Philadelphia or in the ratifying conventions afterwards. I think Jefferson's presence would have been more significant than Adams's, because Jefferson would have split the Virginia delegation, which was under Madison's control and was very much in favor at that time of a very strong central government. No equivocation. I don't know how you, and Madison worshipped the ground that Jefferson walked on. He was like an acolyte. Jefferson didn't really want a fundamental change in the Articles. He just wanted a slight revision. Maybe he wouldn't have attended. I'm not sure. Adams would have caused a lot of trouble. He would have spoken a lot because he thought a lot about this. But I think his major contribution would have been in keeping with the Massachusetts delegation's commitment to a Federalist ideological position. In some ways, it's a shame that he wasn't there, because if it's between him and George Mason in Virginia as to who's the most sophisticated constitutional thinker of that generation. He did write the Massachusetts Constitution single-handedly in 2 weeks. He came back for like 2 months from France in 1779. They happened to be having the Massachusetts Constitutional Convention. He's elected to the convention, one of 128 people. They appoint a committee of like 15 people. That committee appoints a subcommittee of 3 people, and the subcommittee appoints him. And he writes it with Abigail reading the drafts every night. It's still the single longest living written constitution in the world. It's been amended, but it's never been changed completely. That ought to be a novel. What you asked should be a novel about what would have happened if you brought those two guys together in Philadelphia. It's a good question. There's a woman over here, right here. Yes, ma'am. Yell, scream. Oh, wait a minute. She's got to talk. Oh, excuse me. She's got somebody over here.
Thank you. This was a personal book that you wrote about them. What was their religious beliefs, and what part did it play in their lives?
Both of them were New England Puritans raised in the Congregational faith. Abigail's father was a Congregational minister at Weymouth, Massachusetts, with a Harvard degree. John's father had wanted him to become a minister. Up until the middle of the 18th century, the vast majority of Harvard graduates became ministers. That's what going to Harvard or Yale meant. It was changing at that moment. Over time, I think John became a less austere Congregationalist and moved towards a Unitarian position. And when they moved their bodies from the Congregational church a few years later, when John Quincy bought crypts for them, they moved them across the street to the Unitarian church. John's position on the traditional John was not as strong as Jefferson on the separation of church and state. After all, Massachusetts had a religious establishment until 1818. You had to pay taxes to Congregational ministers. He was, however, an agnostic on the question of whether or not there was life after death. Does that help? Find somebody for me. There was a woman right there, right? Here comes the mic. There we go.
Your research was based a lot on their letters. What are future historians going to do about research in cyberspace?
I don't know. I was confessing to a dinner to most of the distinguished, illustrious members of this board that I'm so technologically incompetent, I can't tell you how things are going to play. I mean, maybe some of these things are retrievable. Maybe some disks will be preserved. Maybe somebody like John and Abigail will think about recording these things. I don't think so. And And so it's ironic as hell, isn't it? That we know that in the 21st century we will actually know less about the private side, not the public side, but the private side of prominent officials than we do of people 200 years ago. That's the reason I stayed back there in the late 18th century.
You want to go over there?
You indicated that the quantity of letters was due to their separation. Is there any way to conjecture how much their relationship was, the quality of their relationship and the endurance of their relationship related to absence makes the heart grow fonder?
Some truth to that. Abigail was really almost clinically depressed between 1780 and 84 because he was gone. And later in her life, one of her sisters asks her, if you had to do it all over again, would you marry the same guy? And she said, yeah. But the way she puts it fits what you're saying. She said, we have suffered so much together, I cannot imagine doing it with anyone else. And so part of this is a very realistic notion of love as something that means surviving difficulty. They did lose three children. One in infancy, one in stillborn and miscarriage, and then Charles. And actually fourth, when Abby dies, when they're both alive. They lost a presidency, although John claimed not to care about that. Abigail didn't want John to go to Paris in 1780. She didn't want him to run for the vice presidency. She didn't want him to run for the presidency. She didn't want him to run for the presidency the second time. She said, you've already got your Holy Grail. You're the leading figure in making the revolution happen, and you're the leading figure in writing the treaty that ended it. That's enough. He would have been better off to leave then, too. But she would never assert in a direct way that she wouldn't let him do it because she didn't want to stand in the way of his own public commitment and career. And he was extremely ambitious. I mean, he wanted to make history. And she had to pay the price for that to some extent. As a absentee mother. And she did a great job. She worried a lot about the children and what would come of them because they grew up without a father a lot. And if you look at what happened to them, there's some reason, you know, to worry about this. And, but I don't know whether you've ever had any children, but I've had three and I still don't figure it out. So any definitive arguments about whether it could have been done differently are totally speculation. Yes, sir. And we'll go over here.
This is a what-if question. Yeah, you mentioned Hamilton before, early on. What would have happened to the early republic if Hamilton had killed Burr? Instead of the other way around.
Not much different. By that time, both Hamilton and Burr were finished politically. Unless Hamilton made a comeback. I think that the what if that's really, I'll go 5 or 6 years earlier. What I didn't tell you is during Adams's presidency, the fear of a French invasion is the rough equivalent of our fear of 9/11. And that's the reason you get the Alien and Sedition Act, and that's the reason you get the Patriot Act in Guantanamo, okay? Both, in retrospect, are exaggerations, but not seen that way at the time. In that fearful culture, Hamilton seizes the opportunity to raise an army, so-called provisional army, of either 15 or 30,000. Washington has retired, okay? Hamilton's career has been spent underneath the aegis and protection of Washington. You remove Washington, and Hamilton goes nuts. Well, Hamilton's correspondence at the time suggests he's going to take this army, he's going to move it south through Virginia and put most of these Virginia Republicans in jail as treasonable critters, including Thomas Jefferson. Then he's going to head towards Florida and take Florida, because Florida is an ally of France. Then he's heading to New Orleans. He's going to capture New Orleans. And then if he's got enough time, he's heading south to take over Mexico. Napoleonic. And Adams stops him by saying, we're not going to go to war with France. We're going to have a peace commission, and we're going to disband the army. Actually, he's not present to see it. He sends Abigail to be his surrogate when Hamilton has to have the final salute to the last remnants of the provisional army. She loves it. But Hamilton is a dangerous figure. And he, in Burr, recognizes himself. Burr and Hamilton are two peas of a pod, and one of them has to kill the other one. It doesn't make much difference at the start, by the time they do it. I got a good chapter on this in a book called Founding Brothers. We have a couple more, then we need to let people escape. Yes, sir.
There's a playfulness to Adams that appears in his writings with Abigail and the relationship, but in all of his other public life, he looks like a very stern and serious character.
Oh, he can be funny in letters to other people, too. Oh, right. Though official documents, that's true. His correspondence with Benjamin Rush of this city is actually one of the most elegiac and funny correspondences, better than that, the Jefferson. He writes between 1806 and 1812, in like 150 letters, back and forth, and they have a thing to say, let's tell each other what we're dreaming. And Rush is himself taking on mental patients at the time. He says he's developed a thing called a tranquilizing chair. And Abigail says, maybe we ought to get you that kind of chair, John. But it's a Mad Hatter correspondence that's really just brimming with funny stuff. He's good. He's good. We got to have somebody on this side over here. There we go.
How did you obtain access to the letters, and where are they kept now?
There are 9 volumes of the letters that have been published. The huge volumes, 600 and some pages each. They're published by Harvard University Press. They are edited at the Massachusetts Historical Society as part of the Adams Papers Project. The Adams Papers Project includes all of John's correspondence with other people, too, but it also includes all the members of the Adams family up to the 20th century. So that means like John Quincy. John Quincy's diary is 63 volumes. Nobody's ever read it, as far as I can tell. Nobody could read it. Some of the letters for the end, the current last volume ends in 1793 when John's vice president, so you don't get anything about the presidency or their retirement. That'll take 5 or 6 years, 7 years to get 3 or 4, 5 more volumes, I think. It moves at a glacial pace. It depends on funding, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But the mother lode is at the Mass Historical Society, 2 blocks from Fenway Park. Sir?
Are the letters available online now?
Are the letters available online now? Some of them are, yes. They have transcribed some of the letters that have yet to be published from their handwritten form to their printed form. There is also, unless you'd like to really show your scholarly mane, 608 reels of microfilm, all of it handwritten, the whole Adams family correspondence. They did that first in the early 50s when they founded a project. But some of it's available. If you call them or email them, they can tell you. There's certain things they got in packages that they can give you. There is a one-volume abridged version of the correspondence published by the two editors at Harvard University Press under the title Dearest Friend. It's the best abridged version of the correspondence, I think. I have a foreword in it that says that, so I can't. All right. How about some women here? We had some women. I'm teaching a women's college. Women to speak out about things. Okay. Yes, there's one right up there.
What do you think of the writings of Gore Vidal in his early America? Gore Vidal.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing this. What?
Gore Vidal.
Oh, Gore Vidal. Oh, yeah. Well, Vidal's biography of Burr is great, as long as you know it's a novel. Vidal's novels at some point become obsessed with a definition of America as having run off the rails into some kind of somewhere around the Civil War, we lost our way. And so it's a kind of lament about the decline of America, which I don't completely concur with. I think some of Vidal's shorter pieces are among the most brilliant little things I've ever read. His essays, I love his essays. He's got a theory in the Burr book that is mischievous in a way that only Vidal can be mischievous, namely that the thing that really provoked Burr to challenge Hamilton to a duel was the fact that Hamilton had insinuated that Burr was having sexual relations with his own daughter, whose name was Theodosia. There's no evidence for that. Vidal claims that it's an inspired hunch. It's the kind of inspired hunch that a fiction writer is allowed to have, but a historian is not. But I tell you, it might be true. One time, I was a consultant for the film on Jefferson made by Ken Burns in the late 90s, and they had a screening in the White House. So I said, "We're not going to that." Ellen, my wife, said, "We're going." And so Vidal was there because he was in the movie too. I mean, he had been one of the talking heads in it. And so Hillary and Bill got up and said nice things about the film, which they had not seen. But Vidal was in the back. He was seated in the back. And I went up to the, you know, there are all these people in military uniforms on, you know, for dress blues and stuff. I said, this guy deserves to be up front. And so I went down and sat next to him in the back. And he said, well, that was very nice. He said, the last time I was here, I told Bobby to go kill himself. And Jack was trying to tell me how stupid I was. And he'd been there in the Kennedy White House. He is a character. He's a real, you know, I'm going on too long. But I did a review of a book of his once in which I made one criticism of him, namely that he was wrong that Washington, he said Washington was broke when he died, which is not true. Washington owned about $430,000 worth of property. And he wrote a six-page response to the Los Angeles Times and condemning me for everything in the gods and green earth. And so the editor of the L.A. Times said, you know what I'd do? I said, what would you do? He said, I would write back and say, Dear Mr. Vidal, oh. I didn't write anything. Sir, what do we got over there? I see that big hand. I think we're about one more question away from twilight time.
I've been waving my hands for
I
so
saw
long.
That, yes.
So I'm going to ask you two little questions. First, did you run into anything which indicated that there were other women in John Adams' life?
No. Adams is pretty straight guy about that. And
he does have some things to say about French women when he first gets over there that probably made Abigail worry. And but there's no evidence whatsoever of any kind of dalliances.
Well, there
and
were.
I know that might sound naive, but he really did love Abigail.
Well, but he was a man and a man of the 18th century.
Watch out! We're on treacherous ground here.
Well, I'm just thinking about Franklin, you know, the Roosevelts, you know, maybe 50 years from now.
Well, the Roosevelts
somebody will come
didn't
up.
Love each other.
Yeah.
Okay. Eleanor and Franklin had a relationship that was based on something other than emotional affinity.
Right.
And Abigail and John really loved each other. But that, by the by, John didn't know how to deal with those kind of women. You know? He just didn't know. What's your other question?
What was his relationship or their relationship to the Jewish community and Judaism in general?
They don't say much about it. There is a Jewish synagogue in Newport that they both comment on that's a good idea that we have freedom of the religion. But they're not as outspoken on the principle of freedom of religion and separation of church as Jefferson. Which is ironic, but it's true, because they are reared in a New England culture where the Congregational Church remains the Orthodox religion. And even as they surrender some of their congregational convictions, that's what they're used to. And they're not used to seeing many Jewish people either. When he's in New York, he makes a point of going to Jewish synagogues and Catholic masses just to sort of find out what's going on. As a kind of educational experiment. But if you're looking for a series of statements that are brimming with, you know, religious toleration from them, you're not going to get it. One more. All right, let's get this guy. He's right next to him.
Abigail had an admiration for Jefferson and had a place in her heart for Mr. Jefferson. Did John convey any jealousy did he find this bothersome in some way and express that to her?
Abigail got along with Jefferson very well when he was with them in Paris, and then when he remained in Paris and they were in England, they exchanged about 12 or 15 letters. Some are very clever and cute by both of them. Abigail begins to break with Jefferson at the same time as her husband does. And it's in the 1790s when they end up on different sides of the chasm between Federalists and Republicans. She thinks that Jefferson has behaved badly and duplicitously. He's paid libelers to libel her husband and her son, which he has, and that she's not going to forgive him for that. And she writes him in 1804 when his daughter dies, his younger daughter, Mariah, dies, I think in childbirth, but it might have been a breast cancer, because Abigail knew the kid when she was a young woman. They called her Polly then, to commiserate. And Jefferson thinks that Abigail's writing to patch things up. And she's speaking for John, too, which he isn't. John doesn't even know about this. And so Jefferson, who usually has perfect pitch for these kind of things, misreads this. And he says, well, I'm ready to forgive you for your sins. And one of them is to appoint John Marshall as a midnight judge, right? And Abigail says, you know, I can't believe what I just heard you say, because there will be no forgiving on your side. The only forgiving will come on this side, and it will not come now. And there's a series of letters that the last one goes, you know, the snake that you released on us, Calendar, writing against the Adams family, has now turned on you. And he's the guy that breaks the Sally Hemings story. And she then says, this is, and nobody ever says this to Jefferson in a face-to-face way, like in a letter, as personally. It is said that you were a man of incredible elusiveness and duplicity and a man without honor. And I must say, they are right. 6 months later, John sees this correspondence. She shows it to him and says, I was unaware that any of this was occurring. I have nothing to say about this at this time or in the future. See, they're really interesting. All you got to do is buy this book, and then you'll know everything there is possibly to know. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.